like I said in the beginning, maybe I'll write a book out of them, you know.
Oh, it's for just for my own information. Probably get around to listening to them and if it's any good, I'll make an outline of it. Maybe write it up sometime. This cast records a little bit different. Most of them don't fire it out of here. I saw another hand. Okay.
I have a question for you. Get back to the show for a few minutes. I was going to show you this video tonight, and he filled a bowl of water, sprinkled the pepper on the surface, and he put soap in it, and the pepper,
reduces the surface tension.
What happened to the pepper? Dispersed?
Yeah. It went away from the soap.
Yeah, it went away from the soap.
It
went out to the sides of the pool.
Well, soaps and detergents lower the surface tension of water. And that makes things sort of disperse and mix better too. The pepper probably kept floating.
Yeah,
it's surface tension. There are several ways surface tension can be measured. One is you can take a drop and put it on a surface of something like Teflon. How flat the drop becomes is some measure of surface tension. But a better measure is to take a loop of wire like that and stick this underneath the surface of water or something else and then pull it up with a very delicate balance, which weighs the effort required to move the thing up through the film on the surface which all liquids have. And if you add a detergent or a soap, the surface tension will always be reduced and it will take less effort to pull that through the skin that is on the surface of all liquids. Question here.
Question. Well, I've seen it done. What happens is as soon as you put the soap on, the pepper immediately goes away from where it was dropped in. It just shoots over the other side.
Uh-huh.
And stays away from it.
What's the joke you're going to tell?
what you do is you take this bowl of water and you say, okay, this whites in the neighborhood decided to build this swimming pool. So I just check the salt and there's some whites in the swimming pool. So the blacks came along and they wanted to go swimming, so the whites said, sure, come on in, so you sprinkle the pepper, and the blacks and the whites are swimming together and having a good time. Then it came, along came the pull-off. Then you drop the soap in, one drop of soap, and everything goes away.
Another pull-off story.
Another interesting thing to do with that is quote-unquote floating a razor blade on the water.
Yeah. Float needles on the water too, particularly if you wax them first. Usually metals will pick up a waxy film just from handling them, and that helps the thing to float. I want to tell you a little more about carbon today. We've got to get on to some other kind of chemistry other than carbon. But carbon chemistry is a big subject, and you could spend 8 years studying it all the way to your PhD in the field of organic chemistry. I mentioned aromatic compounds last time, which are based on benzene rings. Now you understand there's a carbon at every corner. There must be four bonds to every carbon, always. And it's understood that hydrogen is there. For example, you see two bonds come there and one there, so that's three bonds. You understand that there's a carbon there and that there's a hydrogen here. Now for shorthand notation, sometimes chemists nowadays will write this. Instead of that, they just do that and put a circle inside. And there's some meaning to that, but we don't want to get into that. We'll still consider carbon with four bonds and the fact that the double bonds are allowed. Now, if you take this to, it's possible, well, that's a hard spot on that border right on. Let's try over here. If you hook a lot of benzene rings together, they have names. I've forgotten the name of two of them together. If you get up to three together, that's anthracene. And more can hook together than that. There can be all kinds the benzene rings hook together. Now, if you analyze what happens as you hook these together, you'll soon discover that the only place that can be hydrogen is around the outside. On the interior here, there's only carbon. So if you hook millions of these together, you may have some hydrogens around the outside, but on the inside it will be just carbon atoms, just solid carbon atoms. And it can be regarded as having these double bonds, and you can arrange them in there so that there are always four bonds to carbon. And these things still have what we call aromatic character. It means this special benzene ring configuration where you have six carbon atoms in a perfect hexagon hooked together.
Now, how are the double bonds arranged in that thing?
Well, you'd have to figure it out so that there's only four to every carbon. Now, let's see if we can do it. Let's just start someplace and put in a double bond. There's one. Okay, so there are four to that point. I could have one here, and there'd be four there, one, two, three, four there. And I guess I could put one over there. All right, now since there are four there, I could put one there, and I could put one there. You just keep going, and you'll find out that they'll, just so you draw it so that there are always four coming to where there's a carbon atom, you're okay. And that could vary, and actually there are always two ways you can do it, depending on where you start. But you can work it out. Start with any number of hexagons hooked together, and it'll work out in two different ways, which are equivalent. Now, if I get a huge sheet of that with millions of those benzene rings in it, those sheets can stack. So if I take this and turn it over like this, the distance between carbon atoms here is somewhere around 2.2. angstroms. And an angstrom is a measure of distance used with atoms. It's 10 to the minus 8 centimeter. That's 1 over 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 zeros of a centimeter. It takes 2.5 centimeters to make an inch. A centimeter is something about that long. Well, this distance, we call it angstrom because it's a convenient unit to use when you're down on the atomic scale of measuring things. Like miles is pretty good up measuring land distances, or feet or yards, depending on what you're measuring. Angstroms are what we use there. Well, now, these layers will stack themselves about 3.5 angstroms apart, something like that.
Are the layers chemically bonded?
Yes, but only weakly. Only weakly. And that substance is called graphite, and it occurs in nature. And I have some graphite here that occurs in Madagascar. Most of the graphite that's used in America comes from Mexico. So you can pass that around. Now, where do we find graphite in normal everyday use?
Lubrication.
Yeah, even more common than that. Pencil lead. See, initially, a pencil lead was lead. They just drew a wire out of the metal lead, and it will write and leave a kind of a weak gray line on paper and other substances. But somewhere along the line, someone found out that you could use graphite and make a much darker line than with lead. But we still retain the name. We still call it a lead pencil, even though it's now graphite. Now, you've noticed that there are hard pencils, such as a 6H if you're a draftsman, and maybe a 2B if you're an artist. An artist may use a very soft pencil for sketching. Now, you change the softness of a pencil by mixing clay with the graphite. You'll take graphite, such as that chunk I passed around, grind it up very fine, and mix it with clay, very fine clay. Add a little water and stir that around, and then extrude it as a wire and then bake it at a bright red heat. And the more clay you put in, the harder the pencil. And the softest of the pencils wouldn't have hardly any clay in it at all. And then they press the wood around it so you won't get your fingers dirty when you're writing. That is perhaps the most common everyday connection that we have with the substance graphite. Now, it was mentioned that graphite is used as a lubricant. That's true. It's also used in dry cell batteries. One of these connections here will be connected to a graphite rod. And if you've ever taken a round battery apart, a little round D cell, you'll notice that there's a black thing going right down the center. Any of you ever do that? Yeah. Well, that's graphite. Now, it's usually hard because it's been mixed with other substances. It's not pure, but it's a black carbon. Now, graphite is soft. It's black. It conducts electricity. And it's kind of slippery, and thus can be used to lubricate locks and things like that. And it has a density, a theoretical density, of 2.25 grams per cubic centimeter. You take a little cube of it about like that, and it has a theoretical density of 2.25 grams. In practice, you hardly ever see that density. Most of nature's graphite only has a density of about 1.81 due to imperfections in the crystal lattice. You'll have a lecture on what crystal lattices are. I have to avoid lots of points that come up or I get way out in left field. We'll talk about crystal lattices somewhere in the next several weeks.
Question? Have a mind cubic centimeter then?
Yeah. Centimeters cubed, not squared. All right, graphite is carbon. It's the element carbon, the thing that we have been talking about. And as you already are beginning to get the idea, carbon is probably the most versatile of the elements in the periodic table. It's associated with life, and in one of its pure forms, carbon is this graphite thing, which is arranged in these hexagonal things, just like a honeycomb of atoms, which then if we tilt this plane up and look in it like this, it's just layers. These are layers of hexagonal rings, okay?
Is there any hydrogen in there in graphite?
Graphite will pick up and absorb oxygen and nitrogen and a lot of other things just from the air.
But it's in there, but it's not bonded to it.
It can vary. The surfaces of substance can pick up all kinds of things. There's a field called surface chemistry. The graphite will no doubt have some hydrogens around here, but it's also, it may have some oxygens bonded between a couple of points, or some nitrogen bonded for 3 points, or just in this huge distance between the planes, there may be absorbed nitrogen, oxygen, or almost anything else that is around. Now, you've raised a question. Have you heard of activated charcoal used in gas masks and whatnot? Yeah, oh, I guess that's right. If you take graphite, or things that are related to graphite that are mainly carbon, and treat them in special ways, and it's kind of a black art, they heat them with steam and they add various metals to them and this, that, and the other, they become very absorbent of gases, particularly when they're cooled down to low temperatures. And they use these in gas masks. During World War I, they found out that if you took peach pits and heated them hot, where there was no oxygen, that they would carbonize. They'd be mainly carbon, but there'd be other things present. And this made an excellent material for gas masks. And during World War I, a call went out across the country, send in your peach pits. And people would take in their peach pits and they'd carbonize them, grind them up to a fine powder, put in the gas mask to absorb the chlorine gas that the Germans had started using in chemical warfare. And so peach pits saved the lives of a lot of soldiers in World War I. Okay?
I had another question about the fact that it conducts electricity. Is that because of the lattice structure and all those carbon atoms are sharing electrons so freely?
It's a property of all the double bonds that are in this thing. Electrons can run around through those things, all through the lattice. Electricity is conducted very poorly in that direction. That's very poor. But along that way, along the sheet, it's a very good electrical conductor. All right, one might say that this solid substance graphite belongs to the aromatic family of organic compounds. Now, the first family of organic compounds that we studied were aliphatic. I spent a long time talking about the non-saturated aliphatic compounds. The saturated ones, where there were no double bonds. Now you see, these aromatic things have double bonds. Half the bonds are double bonds. Also, in the aliphatic compounds, we talked about the tetrahedral carbon atom. The carbon atom tended to bond three bonds down like that and one up here, where all the angles are equivalent. Each angle is 109.35 degrees, if I remember the number. You go between any two bonds, and it's that angle. Any pair of bonds, it's that angle. Now, one would wonder, well, could we form a solid substance where carbon atoms went on by the millions of atoms in three dimensions with tetrahedral bonds? And the answer is yes. And what do you think the name of that solid substance is?
Diamond.
That's diamond. So if we take the aromatic carbon arrangement, the benzene rings, and extend it out for millions of atoms, we have the black solid graphite, which occurs in nature naturally. If we take the tetrahedral, completely saturated kind, no double bonds allowed, you see, and extend this off, carbon atom after carbon atom for more tetrahedral bonds, which is awfully hard to draw. Maybe I'll bring a model over and show you one of these days. Then you have diamond, and both these substances occur in nature. However, the diamond is very rare, whereas the graphite is rather common. The graphite is worth about 25 cents per pound. The diamond, in its least expensive form, which is tiny diamond grits, is worth $5,000. Let's put it in cents. 500,000 cents per pound. And that ratio, I guess, is 20,000 to 1 in value. So you can see why guys have been interested for the past couple of hundred years in taking graphite, which is nothing but carbon, and turning it into diamond, which is also nothing but carbon. Diamond consists just of the element carbon, the pure element carbon, and it is the only gemstone that is a pure element. All the other gemstones are compounds, more than one element present. For example, sapphire is aluminum and oxygen. That's a rather simple one. But tourmaline and many other kinds of things will contain three or four elements in their composition. Diamond is just pure carbon.
You mean it doesn't have any hydrogen bonds on the outside of it?
Well, maybe on the outside, but so you've got a billion, 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 billion atoms in this one carat crystal, and you've got just a billion hydrogens around the outside. It's less than a billionth of a percent, so it's essentially just pure carbon.
What happens when the cut down is in? Does it automatically link up with hydrogen?
It'll link up with whatever's around. And guys do experiments like that. They'll break a diamond in a vacuum and then let gases in to see how it picks them up. Any substance will do that. There's a whole field of surface chemistry that we will never touch in this class. They're just concerned with the fact if you expose a fresh surface of anything, some metal like iron or zinc or carbon or whatnot, and then see what gases go on the surface. It will always pick up gases because, see, there will be free bonds at the surface where it's not bonded back to other atoms of its own kind. So there's a surface energy on every surface, and that's a separate and independent and important branch of chemistry, which we just won't get into.
Okay, Jeff?
What kind of things in the diamond give it? Characteristic colors like blue and green.
impurities or strain among the atoms. That is a lack of perfection in the crystal structure. So there are two things. Crystals can have impurities in them. For example, nitrogen in diamond will make it green. Boron in diamond can make it blue. But just strain, plain old strain in the crystal lattice can make it certain colors. You can artificially color diamonds, a greenish color, by bombarding them with neutrons. It upsets the crystal structure, makes it so it's not as perfect as it was before, and that adds what the physicist calls F-centers. It's a matter of changing the location of electrons because you change the location of atoms. And color goes with electrons and electronic motion. Electronic motion in an atom gives color.
Did you use graphite when you synthesized the diamond?
Yeah. Started with graphite, turned the 25-cent stuff into the $2,500 stuff, or the $5,000 stuff.
And how much does it cost to do that?
Not too much nowadays. It's good racket. Better than stealing. I don't know how many lectures I'll end up giving you on diamond. Let's start off on one and see how far we can get today. Now, under the heading of diamond, which you now understand to be carbon atoms arranged tetrahedrally by the billions going out in three dimensions, by the billions of billions of billions, huge numbers, going out in this tetrahedral fashion. We have some subclasses of diamond. The first class we will call mono. The word mono means single crystal. I think you have an idea of what a crystal is. You've seen crystal chandeliers. You've probably seen in a mineralogical museum, maybe the one here in BYU, crystals of various minerals, stibnite, calcite, calcium sulfate, and things like that. Well, inside a crystal, atoms are arranged in a perfect order. They're arranged in a perfect order, and this order extends on for huge distances, many billions and billions of atoms. Diamond crystals tend to grow in natures as octahedral crystals. That's a crystal that has eight sides. I'll try and draw what goes behind. They tend to grow like that. Now in growing, they will bump into other minerals. They will include these other minerals. And then during the eons of geological time, they'll get bounced around in river gravels and frost action and all the other geological processes. And they will wear some. Even though it's the hardest of all substances, it may wear. They tend to wear a little bit roundish. Now diamond can also form where the apexes, the corners of the octahedra, are squared off like that. They're just cut off and there's a square facet on all of these points. Now that's called a cubo-octahedron, and there are a lot of those that occur in nature. Also, diamond can occur in nature just as a plain old cube. They are rather rare. You see, this cubo-octahedron is a combination between the cubic form and the perfect octahedron. The external arrangement of faces on crystals, mineralogical crystals and whatnot, does not depend on the geometry of the atoms inside. It depends on other factors. These external characteristics that crystals have, a geologist will refer to as morphological features, or he will speak of the morphology of the crystal. Morphology. That refers to the different crystal habits or forms, the external shapes that a crystal can take. And this depends on how it grew, the temperature, the pressure, the solution from which it grew, and things like that. But it has nothing specific to do with the internal arrangement of the atoms. They would be the same inside. monocrystals, particularly this octahedron, are the things that are sought after to make the gems. That's what they make the rings out of, a monocrystal. Now, 20% of the diamonds that are found in nature are monocrystal and are of good enough quality that you can make gemstones out of them. You can cut them to make gemstones. I should call this subheading A. Now let's get down to a B. Also monocrystal. Let's see, I should call a gemstone the A heading, I guess. And now the B heading, we will call bort, B-O-A-R-T. This is still monocrystal. It's still fairly large, single crystals of diamond, but it's very poor quality. It's cracked, it's flawed, it may be black instead of tending to be water, white, or yellow. Most gemstones tend to be slightly yellowish, but when they cut them, the yellow color is not so obvious because of all the refractions and reflections that you see. But a canary yellow color is the most common gemstone color. The bluish ones are the ones that are very expensive and quite priced. The bort may be black or brown or real dark, full of cracks and inclusions, foreign material that has grown with the diamond in nature. The bort is often quite large. Bort will appear in pieces about as big as the end of your thumb, quite commonly. So it's the real poor quality. Monocrystal. Now the thing that happens to bort is that they break it up. Into what is called diamond grit. Is it hot in this room or is it just me?
Warm.
Pretty warm. Why don't you fellows open the window back there? Yeah, fine. This constitutes approximately 80%. Kind of diamond, and this stuff goes to industrial use. Now there's a class of diamond that we would call polycrystal. I don't have any gemstones to pass around, so, but I think you know what they look like. Now, polycrystal means that we have monocrystals, but very tiny ones, microscopic in size. And we have millions of them, and when they are oriented every which direction, the stuff is called carbonado. So if you can imagine in your mind little tiny diamonds, microscopic in size, by the millions, which have grown at random with respect to each other, you will have lost the octahedral shape because they've grown into each other in every which direction. So they'll be irregular like a three-dimensional jigsaw puzzle, all grown into each other. That stuff is usually black or brownish in color, and it's called carbonado. And here's a $200 piece of carbonado I'll pass around for you to look at. And I bet you wouldn't even give me a nickel for it if I'd offered it to you without telling you what it was, would you? You can take it out of the bottle if you want it. Let me get it around here. Pass it around. Out of the bottle. Don't lose it, though. That stuff is rare. It's scientific articles of a few years back would say that nature gave us 0.15% of this kind of diamond, but it's even less than that, because I have the figures on last year's production. In 1973, there were only 2,500 carats mined of that kind of diamond. Now let me tell you what a carat is. Let's start with a pound. You're familiar with a pound. How many ounces in a pound? 16 ounces in a pound. And let's see, 16 ounces per pound. Now, how many grams are there in an ounce?
28.
There are 28.3, I think, grams per ounce. So I give you an idea of how much a gram is. It takes 28 grams to make an ounce. A gram is a unit that a chemist often uses in his work. All right, a carat is only a fifth of a gram, which means there are five carats per gram. A good quality gem diamond of 1 carat weight, good diamond that's cut, worth today anywhere from $600 to $6,000, depending on how blue white it is and so on. And it takes five of those to make a gram, and you see it takes 28 grams to make an ounce, so they're pretty valuable depending on their weight.
No, I don't trust you.
Question back there?
Yes, can you tell the difference
between the engagement ring? Sure, you want me to test out your engagement ring? Well, we're detoured a little, but I guess that's all right. There are no man-made true gem diamonds being sold. Now, they've been made, but they're not being sold. Yeah, you see advertising in the Sunday supplement and lots of times on TV every day, man-made diamonds for sale as gems, cheap, $30 to $60 a carat. There's no carbon in those things whatever. It's a cheat. They're fooling you. And some of their extravagant claims are so wild that I'm surprised the government agencies don't get after them. Now, they're the best imitations that man has ever made, but they don't contain any carbon whatever. They are known as YAGS, Y-A-G-S. They're made of the elements, yttrium, aluminum, usually iron, silicon, and oxygen. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 elements, but you do not even see the element carbon appearing in that list. A true diamond is 100% carbon. That element alone is extremely unique. The only gemstone that is a pure element. Well, now you say, how do you tell these? Well, for appearance's sake, they're very good because the refractive index is the same, and they belong to the cubic crystal system, which makes them singly refractive. These are some terms you probably haven't heard, but it's true. as of a few years ago, the imitation diamonds were actually zircons, which are made out of zirconium and oxygen. Or there are titanium, which is titanium in oxygen. Or they were white sapphire, which is aluminum and oxygen. Now, these things are rather pretty, but every one of these is doubly refracting. What we mean by that is if you pass the light through the crystal in certain ways, the light will come out in two rainbows instead of one rainbow. With diamond, you only get one rainbow out. it refracts twice. It depends on the internal crystal structure. It's a complicated thing. But they were too flashy. I could sit here and spend the rest of the semester telling you about my experiences with phony diamonds, because people are always coming to me. Let's see if I can conjure up a couple of them. Well, my neighbor came in one day, for one example, with a 5-carat beauty. Really, really cut. 5-carat. He was all excited because this had been sneaked into Mexico by guys who sneaked it in from Palestine. See, the state of Israel is just full of diamond cutting enterprises and diamond enterprises. Jewish people have always specialized in this area. You have a vast amount of wealth in a small, why, man, with a fistful of the right kind of diamonds, you're a multi-millionaire, you know. Anyway, little countries like to specialize in things where there's a lot of money connected. And they do diamond cutting and diamond sales from there. Well, somehow, you know, the story was these had come from Israel through Mexico and illegally into the United States. But he knew how to get this thing legal, and he was getting a franchise and all this, that, and the other. And he had only paid something like $750 for this 5-carat beauty. And I looked at it, and I could see it was too sparkly. You'd see too many greens and reds. Now, you see greens and reds in a genuine diamond, but not like this. They really flash Christmas colors, green and red. So I suspected it was a zircon. But I couldn't convince him. He'd had this on the highest authority from the right guys that this was a genuine diamond. I said, well, let's go to the lab and make some simple tests on it. Now, the best test to make is an X-ray diffraction test. X-ray diffraction is a fingerprint, just like a fingerprint can identify you or me. Minerals are the same way. An X-ray diffraction of any mineral will tell you what it is. Well, this diamond was really too big to put in the X-ray machine. The best we could have done was tried to get a little point of it in there, and there are some simpler tests. I said, would you be willing to let me try to scratch tungsten carbide with this? Just the tip. See, it was a brilliant shot, very, very beautiful thing like this. It comes down to a point here. This point was sharp. Now, sometimes this point is called the cullet, C-U-L-L-U-T, maybe or T. I don't know how you spell it. Maybe it's only one L. It's a certain combination of L of T's, and I don't know where I got it. That point is called that if you flatten it a little bit. If it's flattened, it's called that. This part of the diamond up here is called the girdle. And on the American Brilliant Cut, there are 58 of these artificial faces or facets. Well, this one didn't have the cure, and it was straight down to a sharp point. So I said, let me scratch a piece of tungsten carbide with that. And I'll bet you a nickel it won't scratch the tungsten carbide. And he was willing to take that risk. I said, now it may flake off just a little bit down to the point. But the cutter can immediately put a little flat on there, which most diamonds have anyway, and then you'd never know it. So I took it and I scratched a long piece of tungsten carbide. And it wouldn't scratch the tungsten carbide. The tungsten carbide actually was wearing down that thing and broke a few little flakes off from it as I tried to pull it across. And I showed it to him under the microscope. He was convinced, but he was kind of unhappy to have paid $750 for it because it's probably only worth a couple of $100 at the most. Well, that's one story. Let me tell you another one. One day I got in the mail package, and I started to open the package, and the interesting thing was that it was kind of a scrawled handwriting in pencil. From looking at the outside, you'd say, poor white trash from the South, or something like that. Well, be careful when you say things like that, though. There was a Harvard professor who, no less than 2 years ago, in a book he wrote, said, the Mormons are just like the poor white trash of the South. He says, they'll never amount to anything. They'll never have any philosophers, scientists, educators, etc., etc. He went on like that just 2 years ago, Harvard professor. You know. I have a friend, George Homer Durham, who's the commissioner of education for higher education in the state of Utah. He was telling me about this in a meeting. He said, boy, he really fired off a hot letter to that guy, telling him to get with it. But because the Mormons, as you probably know, have for over 40 years been the dominant producer of cyanide, just to mention one thing, compared to our population. State of Utah, matter of fact, that's a good thing for you guys to read. Science Magazine. I don't know how many issues back. Sometime within the past 3 months. Now that's a weekly. It has an article written by a BYU professor, but it's not prejudiced because the compiler of these kind of statistics has usually been a non-Mormon at Columbia University, who year after year, for over 40 years, has compiled statistics on where physical scientists come from. Now what Hardy does, Hardy is the name of the BYU prof. What's his first name? Anybody remember?
Ken.
Kenneth Hardy? Kenneth Hardy. Have you read the article? Do you know where it is?
I had it for class.
Somebody get hold of the article and Xerox off a few for your friends to read, will you? Be a good thing for you to know. Build up your pride in your religion a little bit. Anyway, Hardy has extended it to other things than science, and we're clear to the top, except in a very few instances. The top, not next to the top. There are a few where we're next to the top, but in most of the categories, we are the top. So it is funny how parochial, to use a word they're always using on us, some intellectuals are at very prestigious institutions. They don't know what's going on in the world. How did I get off on that? What was I talking about before I did?
Package and scrawl and pencil.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Okay, I got the package open. And inside there was this cheap, you know, these cheap notebooks you get at 15-cent stores where the paper's real grayish, sort of newspaper-like. Well, it was a torn-off chunk of that. And then scrawled on there was a letter to me. Must have been a fairly good chunk of that paper because she wrote on both sides and got off a letter that says, Dear Dr. Hall, she'd read something about my work at making diamonds. And had been a man come around who had sold her this diamond for $125. And she'd had it for a couple of years and it was getting so it didn't have its sparkle anymore. And she was wondering if he had cheated her. And she had a dollar bill in there. And she wondered if I would take this dollar bill, I would take her diamond and put it in my high pressure machine and put the sparkle back on it again.
Is that the diamond in the mail?
Or yeah, well, I checked the thing out. And it was a sapphire. Not bad. It was a white sapphire made by man. The Lindy Company has been making sapphires for a number of years. Lindy Company can beat nature all hollow on making beautiful sapphires, any color you want, including star sapphires. And they sell them for a mighty good price. But this is a white one. The white ones are the easiest to make. And they don't have the luster of a diamond. But it's not a bad stone. And it was in a platinum setting, which wasn't bad. I think it was worth $125 when I told her so. But that was the dirtiest ring I'd ever seen in my life. You know how a ring gets dirty after you wear it for 2 years and haven't taken a bath for 2 years? Well, that's the way this ring was. It was really a filthy ring. And that's why I got the poor white trash business in there. So what I did, I took it down to a jeweler friend of mine down at Zales. Jack Jess, a guy I've known ever since I was a kid in Ogden. In fact, he used to be in the bishopric in the ward I lived in. And jewelers have a sonic bath for cleaning rings. And he stuck it in the sonic bath and it shook all that grease and dirt off there in a hurry. And it looked quite good. So I sent a ring back to her and included her dollar bill and told her that I decided to report to her that it wasn't a diamond, that it was a man-made white sapphire. The setting was a pretty good setting and that and it was probably worth what the man had charged it for, but it was not diamond, was never diamond, and there's no way I could put it in my high-pressure machine and turn it into one. And I never heard from her again. It's not a bad ring, actually, cleaned up. Do you have any more questions about these phony things that they sell for diamonds?
I have a question about your diamonds.
Louise, they are diamonds.
They aren't sold at all, artificial diamonds?
Not for gems.
But for industrial
purposes? For industrial purposes. The diamonds I invent, $100 million worth of them are sold every year worldwide, which I get nothing. I'm sorry to report. There's more to the story yet, but we'll get to that before the end of the course, I hope. Question over here.
Did you say that those yaks are, do they have a single
refraction? Yes. And they managed to make them with a density fairly close to diamond, and they match the refractive index very closely. Now, they'll tell you that they're as hard as diamond, but they're not. Let's speak about the hardness scale. We haven't said too much about hardness. One trouble with the class facing this way, there isn't enough black border.
Well, let's turn the chairs around.